Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema.
Hi everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdell. I'm a writer and film critic, and today I'm going to be talking to George Stevens Jr., who is the author of My Place in the Sun, Life in the Golden Age of Hollywood and Washington. What, you say? Haven't we had this episode before? No. We did have an episode about him writing the book, and we did talk to George, but we wanted to talk to him one more time because the audio version of the book is out, and that is a great version to listen to if you haven't already read the book, because George has a very distinct voice, not only in terms of his writing but in terms of his voice. So it's great to listen to those stories directly from the author's mouth, so to speak. If you enjoy the episode, please remember to like, share, and do all those things I ask you to do every week. But before you do any of that, please enjoy the conversation.
It's hard work. It takes a lot of time. But I've, and also if you're a filmmaker, or you know everything's done in the editing. So I had, and your own voice, you're particularly picky. That had a wonderful editor in this virtual world, a fellow named Mark Gallup in Nashville, who does a lot of the major books. And he was very, before we started, he said, I know your background and I'm willing to work as hard on this as you are. So I never felt that I was imposing on him by going over and over stuff.
Was there anything that when you were rereading the book for the audiobook, when you were recording it, were there any, it sort of gave you an opportunity to look at the book again, I imagine, and go through those stories. Was there anything that sort of surprised you?
No, it was really interesting. There were a few things I needed to adjust just for practical reasons, but it made me feel rather good about the book, that I wasn't cringing or saying, oh my God, I've got to change this or do this. So I was very happy from that standpoint.
And how has the reception of the book been for you? I mean, I've read some really nice reviews out there, and I imagine there are a lot of people who it's refreshing a lot of memories of their own experiences as well.
It is. I mean, I've just been so touched by the response. I mean, you know, kind of busy people who read every, you know, insist they read every page and what they took from it. And, you know, it certainly seems to intrigue readers, and I'm happy about that.
In a way that we've got a real fascination at the moment with that period of Hollywood. I'm thinking of some films which have come out in the last year or so, you know, I mean, a little bit earlier, the Damien Chazelle film, a little bit earlier, obviously, in terms of the period Hollywood. And you had Andrew Dominik's Blonde as well, going over sort of. But those films seem to give a very dark image of Hollywood. Do you recognize any of that version of Hollywood when you...
No, I really didn't relate much to Blonde or Babylon. They just, you know, it's... I mean, I don't want to become the film critic, but those did not connect to me. And indeed, they were dark. But, you know, and in the case of Babylon, I admire the director, and somehow I just never got engaged with the story.
I know what you mean. There was one scene in that film where Brad Pitt's character talks to a gossip columnist, and it was like, it was by far the best moment in the movie. And it was just two people in a room talking. And that was the best thing in the whole film. And it was just like, oh, we need a bit more of that. We needed a little bit less of the parties and a bit more of two people actually having a human conversation.
I do think about today the sort of sustainability of the films of that era. Mm. Of course, Turner Classic Movies is prominent in the United States. But there are just so many good films and engaging films of that period. And I'm trying to sort it out, whether it's, you know, because one wants to be cautious that, you know, one that you have have old timers disease. Mm. But there are not as many films of any other era that seem to connect over such a long period of time with the audience. And of course, I'm involved, well, first from the standpoint of the American Film Institute and film preservation, and then in a particular sense with my father's films, which it has been a kind of a part-time job, seeing that they continue to exist and are restored. But you know, this is Shane is 70 years old this year.
And, my word.
And people seem to be absorbed when they watch it. And last year, we did a restoration of Giant, and Steven Spielberg called me a year before that and said, "Your father's Giant is a masterpiece. I think with the 4K tools that the long dissolves, it could be greatly improved." And he got the Film Foundation and we collaborated on a restoration. And for those who don't remember, many passages in the film, the storytelling is overlapping dissolves. And of course, from that era, there was not a three-strip Technicolor, it was single-strip Eastman color. And they didn't save the elements. So you have that kind of degradation, and some of the beauty of the film, that style of storytelling was muted. And we did this restoration, and it was Stephen and I introduced it at the Turner Classic Movies Film Festival last April. And we went to the Chinese Theater and we talked about the film with Ben Mankiewicz, the host of Turner Classics. Then watch this audience. I did say at the introduction that it was 65 years ago last year that Giant premiered at the Chinese Theater in Hollywood.
Wow.
And Ben asked for a show of hands, how many had seen it, how many had seen it on the big screen, how many hadn't seen it at all. You know, I guess 1,000 people were there in the IMAX theater with a huge screen, seeing this film that just unfolded as if it were made yesterday, and its themes of the independent woman, the conflicts with racial, with the Hispanic population, and so much else, immigration, made it so current for today. So it is a pleasure when some of these great films last and can be seen in their best form.
That's a film that has such a legacy of influence as well. I watched it recently. I rewatched it because working on the Terrence Malick book, and Days of Heaven has, you know, has obvious influences. And There Will Be Blood would be another one that I think is very influenced by Giant. And so those are, you know, two classics in their own right, but they all have this lineage, I guess.
You know, it's interesting. You remind me, I know you're writing a book about Terrence Malick. Just an odd thing Terry said to me one day years ago when he was a fellow at the AFI, and I think we had screened Giant. Because we were talking about Giant. And he said, kind of shook his head. He says, you know, I could never do that scene with the turkey where the children, they're out in the garden and Leslie, his mother's and father's house, and they see the turkey, and then the turkey's they're having this joyous Thanksgiving dinner, and the turkey comes in and the kids start to cry. And then it develops with a letter from Bick and all of that. But it would just be funny if Terry sort of said, I don't think I can do that.
What would he find difficult, getting the children to cry? Or?
Well, I think just the concept. It was Laurel and Hardy, you know.
Right.
I mean, it was just a different skill.
It's really interesting you saying about watching these films in their original format, because when I go to film festivals, I always try to go to see the retrospectives, because even if I've seen a film 4 or 5 times, seeing it on the big screen in that format is like seeing it for the first time.
Isn't it? And it is. You're happy that people are seeing it on, you know, television, you know, in good form, I guess on their phones. But it's just such a vast difference of, you know, we made a film when I was working at USIA during the Kennedy years on the March on Washington, James Blue. And it was a very good film. It stands the test of time, with Martin Luther King's great speech. But I would run it in a screening room at USIA, and we made it in 35 millimeter, but we also had 16 millimeter prints, and it was about a 40 seat screening room. And I could tell the difference in the response when I'd run it with a 35 millimeter print and a 16 millimeter print. You know, it's an emotional experience, and people just more engaged and more feeling with the crisper image.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a sort of immediacy that comes out with that experience. And I think today, especially, the idea that you go to the theater and you hopefully are not looking at your phone and it absorbs your attention completely, you know, I think that is something which the theatrical experience excels at.
It does.
Thinking about your father's movies, and you mentioned Shane, which, by the way, I only recently, I think it was following our conversation, I read the novel that Shane is based on. And it is a great read. It was one of those Library of America editions of anthology of Western novels. And so I read that and a few others, all of which I think had been made into films. I think it was The Oxbow Incident, Shane and the Searchers was the other one.
Did I tell you about my summer job? My father was back from the war, and I graduated from high school. I was 17, and I didn't have anything to do before going to college. Then he said, "Do you want to help me?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, there are two tasks. One is I want you to break down and put in two notebooks, part one and part two, of Theodore Dreiser's American Tragedy. The characters, the situations, because he was about to start the screenplay of A Place in the Sun based on the Dreiser book. And the other was to read the books and scripts that came from Paramount, you know, for his consideration. And I was, as I say, 17, and reading a lot of treacly love stories on hot summer afternoons, which was not very compelling for me. And one afternoon, a book was on the pile, and I picked it up, a small book, and I read it, and I went over to my father's bedroom that night and said, "Dad, this is really a good book. I think you ought to read it." Well, but he said, "Why don't you tell me the story?" So I paced around his bedroom, trying my best to tell him the story of Shane. And then the next summer, I had my first job working on the location of Shane in Wyoming.
What was that experience like?
To work on a film with that kind of ambition, though I don't think any people were especially conscious of its ambition, was just such an experience to kind of cut one's teeth on the making of a film. And it was a script that needed work throughout. And I just to see under pressure how a film is created was extraordinary. And to see that fascinating character of Jack Palance arrive from New York and see him for 2 weeks out working with a wrangler, getting on a horse and getting off a horse, drawing a gun and putting it back in the holster. And just to see all the detail that goes on behind the scenes to make these images that eventually become a film. And it was on that picture where I learned that the real experience is in the editing room, because to see that film put together and the time and patience and the redoing and redoing and sharpening, that is really where so much of the storytelling takes place.
It always strikes me as quite a surprisingly violent film as well. The violence is very, I think there's that scene where Palance kills one of the farmers and he sort of flies through the air. And I don't think I'd ever seen that before in a film of that,
no, that
vintage.
It was always that the person gets shot and he grabs his stomach and falls forward. And in that case, we actually spent an extra day because the street wasn't wet enough. Mm. And Dad had asked them to wet the street, and it wasn't. So we didn't work on Saturday and came back on Sunday to shoot that scene. And then by then, that street was a sloshy, muddy, where that young Elisha Cook Jr., a Stonewall Tory, has to walk toward Jack Palance standing on the porch of the saloon, baiting him forward and him slipping in the mud. But they had taken him and put a vest around him and attached wires to it. And on the other end of the wires, when the scene was shot, were three grips, stagehands. And when he was shot, and they'd buried a mattress in the mud. And when he was shot by Jack Palance in cold blood, they pulled that thing and he flew back dead into the mud.
It's such an amazing effect and so shocking.
Sam Peckinpah referred to that as the scene that changed. He said that the Apaches used to get shot and get up and shoot again. And he said after Elisha Cook fell in the mud, there was a change in how people were put away on the screen.
That's so interesting, because that's such again, that interesting line between, the classic cinema of your father's period and then going up into someone like Peckinpah, who sort of considered a counter, sort of a revolutionary figure in some ways, but you see that he has his inspiration in your dad's work.
Interesting. Someone just sent me the current Sight and Sound, where Tony Kushner, our great American playwright and screenwriter of Lincoln, three Spielberg films, Munich, I believe, and The Fablemans. But Tony is a great artist, and he picked the three films that most influenced him, William Wyler's The Heiress, Fellini's Amarcord, and Shane. Mm. And he speaks to the violence and the integrity of the film. My father referred to that shooting of Elisha Cook by Jack Palance. He said, for us, that is a Holocaust. Mm. And it was that his experience coming back from the war and having seen people shot, killed, and he was looking at movies and seeing them shoot and get up and shoot again, get shot and shoot again. And he wanted to express that idea of the the gun and its violence. And again, how interesting it is that that is a primary issue in our American society today, this unwillingness to recognize that it is a deadly weapon.
We need some more films with integrity to address those issues. There are plenty out there, I'm sure. I don't want to succumb to the old man's disease either.
Yeah, exactly.
There are some wonderful films out there. I mean, it's an impossible question, I know, but of your father's films, is there one that you have a particular, it's difficult to place every one above the rest, but is there one that you have a particular fondness for?
I guess fondness in different ways.
Right.
Gunga Din was the film I used to run on a 16 millimeter projector when I was 11 years old. And it's so resonant with me in the comedy and the wit of it, and also the humanity of it, that the beastie, the water bearer, wants to be a soldier, and he ends up with this wonderful funeral where the British commandant says, "You're a better man than I am, Gunga Din." I mean, I make it sound awful, but it's still a wonderful film, albeit a colonialist-based film. But Shane and Giant in A Place in the Sun, where, that trilogy, I really can't single one out. And The Diary of Anne Frank, on which I worked with my father, and Swing Time with Fred and Ginger, perhaps the best, or at least Arlene Croce, the great critic, says it is the true Astaire Rogers picture. And so I'm not good at singling it out. And at the Turner Classic Festival this in April, Alexander Payne and I are introducing Penny Serenade with Carrying and Irene Dunne. And I just, again, look forward to seeing it with an audience on a big screen, because I bet hardly anybody alive today has seen it on the big screen.
And those comedies with Cary Grant are so good to see with an audience, because they're still... I saw The Philadelphia Story in Liverpool at the Royal Philharmonic. And huge theatre, usually used for concert halls, but they have a screen that comes up from the stage, and an organist plays, and they show these old films once a month. And we saw it there, and it was a full house. So it's got to be at least 1,000 people. And it just... people crying with laughter, it absolutely still works to this day.
Yeah, no, it is extraordinary. And I'll tell you a story. I went to the 1952 Academy Awards with my father, and we were sitting together, and Joseph Mankiewicz comes on the stage. He'd won the Oscar the year before for The Lady Eve, and he reads the nominations. John Huston for The African Queen, William Wyler for Detective Story, Vincent Minnelli for An American in Paris, Elia Kazan for A Streetcar Named Desire, and George Stevens for A Place in the Sun. Well, I wouldn't be telling you this story if John Huston had won. But riding home that night, and I must have been about 17 or 18, and my father was driving the car, the Oscar is on the seat between us, my mother and his actress grandmother in the back seat. And he looked over at me and he said, we'll have a better idea what kind of a film this is in about 25 years. On that night of triumph, he was aware, and this is before Cinematheques and DVDs and streaming, pictures came and went, but he had in his head, having grown up in the theater, seen his father do the great plays, that, that the test of time was really the measure of art. Well, of course, he didn't know he was talking to the future founder of the American Film Institute, of which the test of time would be at the heart of its film preservation and training new filmmakers, and or the Kennedy Center Honors, which was about the test of time and celebrating the greatest artists of our time. And, so I look back on that, and I now realize, that something was sparked somewhere, and perhaps it was in that conversation.
Absolutely. And I you know, we've just had the Oscars have just come and gone quite recently. And he's right that it's not true necessarily that the picture that wins the best Oscar, or the director who wins the best director, that film then lasts, then passes the test of time. I can think of a few recent winners which we don't really talk about at all today. And, you know, despite triumphing on the night, so to speak.
Yeah, that you can't imagine that people will be watching in 20 years, much less 70 years. And so it is, you know, there are ones that I think will be, but some of the recent ones that you are referring to were really pictures of that particular year.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they had something that was there, but yeah, perhaps not, certainly not as enduring as all of the as others other films who have won. Talking about the AFI and your the foundation of the of that, I mean, that was a very forward seeing project. How did you get involved in that?
I had my early career in Hollywood, and when working with my father, then I was directing television, Peter Gunn and Alfred Hitchcock Presents and things like that. And then worked with my father on The Diary of Anne Frank, where I directed the location scenes. And I was moving right along, sometimes saying to myself, I'm going to spend my life becoming the second best director in my family. And then Edward R. Murrow came into my life and asked me to come to Washington. He had agreed to run the United States Information Agency, telling America's story abroad for President Kennedy. And I...
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
We went there and we had what they call the golden age of USIA films, with all sorts of wonderful young filmmakers making the films. And Kennedy initiated the National Endowment for the Arts, the first funding for the arts by the government, federal government in the United States. And they knew what to do about opera, dance, symphony orchestras, all of that. But movies, they didn't know what to do. You can't give a grant to Warner Brothers, you know? And I had been active in the Kennedy years. I kind of became the person to talk to about film. So they asked me, and I suggested an American Film Institute. There was some discussion, and when Lyndon Johnson signed the legislation in the Rose Garden of the White House for the National Endowment for the Arts, he said to everyone's surprise, we will have a national opera, we'll have that was not to anybody's surprise, national symphony, national ballet, none of which happened. But then he said, and we will create an American Film Institute where young filmmakers will this and that and preserve the films. And suddenly we had an American Film Institute, and I was asked to start it, to run it.
Must have been very exciting that period. Were there any organizations around the world that were already going that you could sort of take inspiration from, or was it the first of its kind?
No, it was not. There was, of course, the British Film Institute already active. They were all different. There was a Polish, I went to Poland, the Czechoslovakia, Russia, Soviet Union. They all had their institutions. Ours was the first that was kind of, quote, non-governmental, although we were dependent upon government funding to a degree. So there were models. And I actually brought screenwriter from the Czech, the Czech Film School, and also Stanislaus Vol, a wonderful cameraman from the Polish Academy, were with me when we started AFI. And later Jan Kadar was on the staff, and Rossellini came for six weeks. And we very much looked to the European experience in creating our own.
In those early days of the AFI, when you had that first year, we have talked about this, but it seems like such an exciting period when you have, you know, Terry Malick and you have David Lynch in the second year and Paul Schrader in the first year. There's a sense in your book of that being a moment where you can, yeah, I can almost hear the sort of hammering of the carpenters in the background as you start the school.
It really was. I mean, we took over this big mansion in Beverly Hills, which the city of Beverly Hills controlled but didn't know what to do with. And they gave it to us for $1 a year. But then we went through a terrible fight with the city of Beverly Hills because the neighbors in these very fancy houses around Greystone, which the mansion was called, were very nervous about having a bunch of film students. And I had to admit that sort of at least 30% of our fellows, as we call them, bore a passing resemblance to Che Guevara. These bearded young people kind of coming up to the gates of this mansion made them nervous, but we worked it out. And it was an interesting one day, a great time at AFI. I mean, that's wonderful theater. We called it the Great Hall. I mean, it's probably 80 seats, but great projection. And we'd have guests, and Fellini came, and Fellini had just made Satyricon, and he came one night to do a seminar with the fellows, and they'd been screening his films leading up to that. And I got calls, I remember, from Jack Lemmon, Sam Fuller, and a couple of others. Can you get me in? They wanted to hear Fellini talk, and they came. And Federico came with Tony Quinn and his wife, Giulietta Messina. And Tony and Federico and I sat at the front, and we had this conversation with the fellows. And one of the tensions at the AFI school was we were kind of proceeding with this idea of, you know, a cinematic idea based on storytelling. And we had certain beliefs about it, whereas the students were, a lot of them were very influenced, and the word very much at large was improvisation. And when there was discussion of writing the screenplay, they said, well, Bob, we're going to improvise that. And Tony Vanni, who was became the real architect of the teaching at AFI, was consistent about, you know, storytelling. And so during toward the end of the seminar, Fellini was obviously tremendously engaging and witty. And a fellow stood up and said, Mr. Fellini, we've been seeing your films, and I know that you do a great deal of improvisation, and I'd like you to talk about improvisation. And I remember Federico said to Tony Quinn, improvisatore? Yeah. And Quinn said, nada, yeah, improvisatore. He says, no. He says, for me, great preparation. He says, for me, making a movie is like, for you Americans, sending a man to the moon. And it totally diffused this insistence on improvisation that had been been a bit of a roadblock in our progress. And to say that this is not to say that you don't do improvisation. Everybody does to a degree in films, but we were contending it's not the basis of great films.
Yeah, it's not the starting point. It might be a tool that you use along the way.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, you had some amazing names in that early, even so. I remember in the book as well, I think you mentioned that John Cassavetes has an office in the AFI.
He did. Yeah, he was a filmmaker in residence for a year. I forget which of his films he was working on, and of course, and John was, you know, kind of illustrates that we were not, as we were sometimes accused of, you know, wanting to make Hollywood factory films. We knew what good filmmaking was and is. And John was actually a filmmaker who depended a great deal on improvisation and did it so skillfully.
How would he interact with the fellows then? Would he be? Would they be? Would he give a couple of lessons, or would they just have conversations? Or
they'd have conversations, and they occasionally run films with him. And he was just a presence, a guy you could talk to.
That's also what I love about the AFI, is this idea that there does seem to be quite a large number of mavericks who become encouraged and promoted. And I'm thinking also of Orson Welles as a figure that comes up in the book, honored by the AFI. Did he actually do any teaching as part of the AFI, or come in and speak to the students?
I don't think Orson ever was at the AFI school, no.
But of course, he was one of those figures who you had quite, that you wished to promote, sort of ensure his legacy remained.
Right. When we started the AFI Life Achievement Award, which would honor the people who, in a fundamental way, had advanced the art of film, in the air quotes, John Ford was the first, and James Cagney was the second. And you could see us going along to Frank Capra and Jimmy Stewart and William Wyler and John, et cetera. But in the third year, in part because of this kind of AFI being criticized as a creature of the industry, which we were not, we honored Orson Welles. And it was a choice of some controversy. Some people complained, but of course Orson was majestic and his work could not be questioned by serious people. And he was a great presence, and I was tremendously fond of Orson.
It must have been a delight, sort of entertaining and just having conversations with these people, having an opportunity to sort of see them in that context.
It was, and Orson, right, and he accepted the award in the name of all the Mavericks.
The subtitle for your book refers to your life as being split between Hollywood and Washington. And so I'd like to talk a little bit as well about the sort of political, that mix of culture and politics, because nowadays we talk about that mixed in a very antagonistic sort of the culture wars. Is the phrase that you hear bandied around. Do you think there's a way back to a more constructive conversation?
I do. But I don't see it on the near horizon.
Right.
As you point out, I've been involved in movies and politics. I was 29 when I went to work for Murrow and Kennedy. And so I've been, kind of close to politics through many presidencies. All during that period, I never questioned, we had Watergate, we had the Vietnam War that went on and on, that I never questioned whether our democratic system was going to continue as it was. And in recent years, thoughtful people really, worry that this is a rather fragile idea, this constitutional democracy. And if we are going to flout the rules, and no rules pertain, where does that take us? And it relates to your question of, how can a country nourish the arts in an inspiring way in this divisive climate where people are going to be suspect, or if you give money to something, they're going to find a reason to make them to cancel. And so it's a tough time. And I do believe, if I have an optimism that persuades me that we will work our way through this.
Yeah, I think there are those great, we do have those filmmakers, we do have those artists who are alive today and who are active today. And, it reminds me of W.H. Auden's, 1939, September 9, little glimmers of light, across the darkness. And of course, that was that was definitely a very dark time in human history. So if Auden can find glimmers of light, I'm sure we can too.
Well, it's interesting. I'm not at a stage where I can talk about it specifically, but my project I'm working on now has to do with the telling of a great story of how not the subject of how the American government came to the rescue, not in a propagandistic way, but it happens to involve fascinating characters. But I think films can reflect some of these eras where the government did its job and was respected. That can be important.
Absolutely, yeah. And I just it's just that idea that there are cultural norms, that there are, I mean, you've referred a couple of times to, you know, thinking people or serious people, you know, and we just need more of those. We need as many of those as possible. And we need a culture that values, you know, for want of a better word, intellectuals and people who are going to think seriously about something.
Yes, you know, that it's a crying need in our country. And you just have to hope that we galvanize enough people. And I must say, there are certainly many creative and bright and committed filmmakers who are, you know, in that spirit, just in the terms of the way they live their lives. And I'm looking forward to Christopher Nolan's film about Oppenheimer.
Me too. I read the biography in preparation.
Yes, something, you know, because he's, when he turns his attention to something, He generally comes through with something of great worth.
Absolutely, absolutely. And he's, of course, someone who's very much working in the medium of film as resisting the onslaught of digital and sort of keeping the faith with film as film, as celluloid.
Yes, and with themes that, you know, are adult themes rather than Marvel Comics themes.
You mentioned Tony Kushner earlier, but The Fabelmans, which was released recently, I'm sure that's a film that you've had an opportunity to see.
Yes, and I think it's a lovely film, and particularly enjoyed David Lynch as John Ford at the end.
Well, I was going to ask, because you've met both of them, so how close was he? How was he?
Really quite astonishing that he captured that sense of John Ford. No, it was a wonderful idea of Stevens, and of course, just a wonderful collaboration.
Well, David Lynch would have met John Ford as well, because in the AFI, didn't Ford come in and give a few talks?
He did. I'm trying to, yeah, he was there when David was there, yes.
It just shows, it's like when you were saying earlier about Alexander Payne presenting the film with you later on in April, just these, you know, the connections between all these filmmakers that continues.
Yes, and I kind of value that, just to connect with that next generation down or two, in the case of Alexander. I'm also Todd Field, who I think did such a brilliant job with Tar. He's an AFI graduate, and I enjoy being connected with, you know, this younger generation, which is an antidote to Alzheimer's disease. I'm on the board of AFI. I have been now for over 50 years since the beginning. And I respect Bob Ghazali, who's the president of AFI. And in fact, you know, we talk about things, and we're talking about a new to consolidate and make accessible all of the information that AFI has in its archives, which is not right now as available as it should be.
One in particular that I know you'll never be able to give me, but I so much want to see Terry Malick's first film, Lantern Mills, because...
The full title was, and I don't know why, but those things stick in your brain. Lantern Mills, Cincinnatus Heiner of the West. I have no idea what the subtitle was meant, but I just remember that's how it was always listed on our production sheets.
Yeah, I've not been able to get a hold of a copy, or all my requests have been turned down. So yeah, it's a little bit of a holy grail.
Isn't that interesting?
You know, yeah.
Terry and I worked together I worked with him on The Thin Red Line.
Right.
And Terry would not allow a still camera anywhere near the set. And there was one picture of Terry that was approved for use. So he has a sense of his own personal identity that he exercises strenuously.
Having written this wonderful memoir, is there a feeling as well of that you'd like to write something else in this vein, maybe a closer look at something?
No, I think that I've done it. I'm very happy with what I've written. It's one of the byproducts of it for me is that I've been able to have these discussions and an opportunity to hear from readers, to talk about things and interests to expand on. And in writing the book, I now look back on it. And one thing that comes to mind is that I had, and my wife Liz, we ended up by virtue of me being the founder of the American Film Institute, having a life in Hollywood and having a life in Washington, and the Kennedy Center Honors, we honored 198 of the greatest artists of our time, and that we had the most amazing people in our lives. And in reading the book, I realized that how much of what you value in life is the people that you know and worked with. And so I kind of have a better understanding of why I wrote the book. I had these stories that I thought I wanted to talk about, these people.
Yeah, it's a way of sort of bringing them back.
Yes.
The last time we talked, you said the person you were most starstruck by was John F. Kennedy. That meet inspired a lot of your life.
Well, it was in response to someone asking me which movie star made the hair on your whatever, you know, kind of question. And I don't really think of any of them that way. And then later I thought of that when I met John Kennedy for the first time, it had that, you know, it was before color television, and to see him kind of walk into a room unexpected in black tie out of the snow outside with no overcoat, and just walk into a room and you see him in a close-up. He was exceptional in that way. And that I had the opportunity to work with him, and he took an interest in the films we were making. And he had such a gift of expression. And one thing that I kind of wrote down, one of his, when I was working on these films at USIA and in this invigorating job of working for Edward R. Murrow, and he spoke of the ancient Greek definition of happiness, the full use of one's powers along lines of excellence. And I thought, my God, that is the opportunity that he and Murrow have given me. This is what I'm doing. And I was so happy. and I stayed with that phrase. And another one just led to the Kennedy Center Honors. The AFI was in the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in Washington at the time it was built. And I proposed the Kennedy Center Honors by saying, there's an idea of the show that the Kennedy Center should be doing, and it's carved in the walls of this building, the words of the president: I look forward to an America that will not be afraid of grace and beauty, that will reward achievement in the arts the way we reward achievement in business or statecraft. That was the event in the television show honoring the great artists. So in so many ways, he was an inspiring figure. And also that sort of new frontier attitude. I mean, I was in a big government agency, but I felt I could do anything, that, you know, that anything was possible. So it is someone I remember in that way.
It's just so inspiring. And I would love to have a larger dose of that today, although I'm sure it will come. I'm sure we will see better days.
I think we have to believe that. And I think that's the way things happen.
What have you been reading, George, by the way, recently? Have you read any good books? I always like to promote other people's books on this on the podcast as well. Anything about Hollywood specifically?
I'm just thinking. I reread Lillian Ross's Picture.
Oh, wow.
The long, long piece she wrote in The New Yorker about John Huston making The African Queen, which is available. And anybody who wants a really good Hollywood story with the sort of barbed eye of a really tough reporter from New York, Lillian Ross was that. A wonderful writer. And at that time, when Lillian Ross came to Hollywood after that, she was quite a figure. And she asked to have dinner with my father. And Ivan Moffat, who was raised in England, had an English accent, and was with my father during the war and worked with him on Shane and A Place in the Sun and Giant, said, Lillian would like to have dinner with you. And Dad said, fine. And he said, and then George invited a fellow named Peckham who ran the fishing department of a store on Wilshire Boulevard, and another guy who was the quartermaster of his army unit. And I said, "Look, George, Lillian doesn't, this is not what she's going to expect." And he said, so we went to dinner, and Lillian was absolutely charmed. They had a wonderful night. And she ended up thinking George was a real regular guy, which of course was what he intended.
Look at me with my friends, my down-to-earth friends.
Yes.
Brilliant. Excellent. Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you for that recommendation. I've just been recently reading rereading Pauline Kael, I should be saying. And that her barbs are, you know, just talking about barbed, her barbs are scintillating. Thank you so much, George, for agreeing to talk to me once more.
It's just always such a pleasure. And we'll keep in touch, John. Thank you for having me back. I'm proud to be on your podcast.
So that was my conversation with George. I had a great time talking to him. It's a huge privilege to talk to someone who has met and dealt with so many people from the history of Hollywood, so many people in the present day Hollywood as well, as you can hear, and somebody who's just so got so many interesting things to say. A wonderful, wonderful guy, and someone who's very generous in supporting this podcast. And so, if you haven't already, you definitely need to pick up a copy of his book, My Place in the Sun, Life in the Golden Age of Hollywood and Washington, which is now also available as an audiobook. So you like podcasts, you'll love audiobooks. It's obvious, isn't it, right? Next week is going to be our 100th episode, and it might come out a little bit later. We're trying to get dates and everything organized, but hopefully it will be a guest worthy of our 100th episode. I'm sure it will. Any guest would be worthy of our 100th episode because all our guests are great. So there you go. I'm not going to do anything special, but it is going to be the 100th episode. So maybe you want to, I don't know, buy me a present or blow out candles or make a cake or something of that kind. Excellent. So until then, till next week, take care.